take two, still the 21st of January 1986, with Sir Peter Ramsbottom. This is the continuation of his time in Iran. And here we go. Now, what I'd like to ask is, when you were called back to England only after 2.5 years, what did you do then? Did you go and see the Shah?
When I was called back to England, I was offered the post of British ambassador to the United States.
Yes.
Which is why I left Persia. And the Shah, obviously, wasn't very pleased at my going after a relatively short time. I think that thought of his was compensated by, he was rather flattered that the British ambassador to his country was going as ambassador to the United States. Mm-hmm. He always thought in terms of comparisons with Iran and so on, and so that was a way of conveying to him that the British had thought very highly, because they were pointing Ramsbottom to America, and therefore they must have sent and all that. Mm-hmm. So he didn't mind too much for that reason. And I went, and there were several occasions when I said goodbye. I think probably I was on one of those last occasions when we did talk about a little bit I mentioned before about his future a little bit, and why when I made the remark that perhaps it would be a good thing that he shouldn't take all the credit for everything, mm-hmm. and allow other people to do so. But I'd, and then I think very nice, and he received me especially and gave me, I think, one of the first of its kind, a new type of coloured photograph. It looks like a portrait, which he and he and the Shah knew had, and they both inscribed it for me and so on. Mm-hmm.
Another thing, although you say that it's in Roger Lewis's book and everything, but of course books are different from this work,
yes.
of oral history. And I believe that there was a documentary a little while ago on the BBC called Fall of an Empire.
That's right, yes, I was on that.
And you were on that, and
yes.
apparently very, very good too. I was told by friends who'd seen it, unfortunately I hadn't seen it. And you did talk at length about the demise of Mossadegh and the coming back of the Shah.
The coming back of the Shah, I knew very little about, because it happened really after my time, and I'd already gone off, was going off to New York on a new post. I had very little to do with the plans for undermining Mossadegh at the end and bringing the Shah back. And my time really ended, it started before Mossadegh, when we hoped that Razmara would become, was Prime Minister, would be able to put the supplementary agreement through the Majlis, but failed, and he was assassinated. I really started about there, and I ended my time as head of the Iraqi desk and the oil desk and the Foreign Office just when the consortium was coming about to be fashioned, and the sanctions against the Iranian oil were completed, just about that time. So I know a little, I can't answer questions about the Rashidian brothers and anything like that.
Well, what did you talk about in the film?
So on the film we talked about Mossadegh and the negotiations that failed with Mossadegh and why they failed, and could we have done better, and did the Americans put pressure on us, and all those sort of things.
Did they?
Element. Not directly, not when I was out in Iran. On the whole, they were very reasonable. I think they wished us to have made further concessions at that time. As it turned out, they were wrong, but I don't think it was because that we were right at that time. I mean, it just so happened things worked that way. And when the Eisenhower regime came in, they supported us more fully on that question. But I think the Americans, we made a lot of mistakes, I think. Largely, it was difficult for us not to go on backing the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company throughout, not only because the government shared it, because it did represent our largest interests. So we were tied to a certain extent by what Willie Fraser, who was then Lord Fraser, I think, did. Which was a handicap to us. I think we made some mistakes on reflection in insisting too much on the legal niceties of the recognition of expropriation and the degree of compensation and those things. I think we could have managed it more easily. I don't think it would have done us any good, because I think Mossadegh had become the prisoner of his own extremism by then. He went around in terror of his life most of the time then. Because he had, rather like Frankenstein, he created this Frankenstein emotionally of nationalism, which, as you rightly term it, and we agreed earlier on, was there endemic in the Persian people, born of their humiliations and frustrations and repentances. And he gave birth to all that, but both on the extreme right, the National Front, it was called, and the Tudeh Party, the Communists, and he unbottled them, so to speak. And he became a prisoner, really, of that extremism. And he had no room for maneuver at the time we were negotiating with him, the Stokes mission, in August 51. Even if we'd agreed almost to everything, he'd insisted, he still couldn't have agreed, I don't think. And there was an Ayatollah Kashani at the time, who was similar, really, to Khomeini today, who could have taken over very easily.
And was he, as they said, at the time, one heard that because the British-controlled clergy was Kashani in relation...
We didn't control the church. I wish we had done. One thing we couldn't control, I think, was that we didn't control very much by then. These were all the myths of earlier influence, British influence, probably before the First World War. Certainly, when we sacked Reza Shah and there onwards, from the days of Rita Bullard, we didn't have much control by influence. I mean, I imagine other countries had just as much influence. Mm-hmm. The Israeli intelligence service was much better informed than ours, what was going on in Iran. Mm-hmm.
So Kashani wasn't
no connection. At all. Absolutely none at all. He was a wordy to us. We had no idea what he was up to.
What about Khomeini? Everybody believes Khomeini is pro-British.
I didn't think we had any touch with Khomeini. We didn't even know. I mean, I was, as a British ambassador, unlike perhaps the American ambassador, the British ambassador controls the Secret Service. I wouldn't have had it otherwise. You can't have another arm of power of your government operating unknown to you. So the British ambassador is in charge of the Secret Service. When I say in charge of, they have their own instructions from London. Mm-hmm. But no major move, and he's not going to bother about individual operations, I guess, but no major move of political kind which could impinge on what he's responsible for, which is all policy matters and things, that could take place without his approval. And the whole time that I was there, I don't know about Tony Parsons any day, I hardly heard of Khomeini. He really left, he was living in Iraq. He counted for nothing. In religious circles, people paid attention to him, but in terms of power, such as I was meant to be concerned with, factors in Iran, he was unimportant at that time. And certainly we had no contacts with him. But whether or not later on things changed, I don't know. I very much doubt it.
But
you want to ask, I mean, but Tony Parsons didn't mention that at all.
Yes, he did. He denied also that they had anything to do with it.
Yes, but I mean, he would tell the truth.
Absolutely. But what about, you mentioned...
I wish we could. We don't have that sort of power. I mean, you're people who think like that attribute far greater deviousness and power and intelligence and skill to the British intelligence service than they have. Perhaps more than that. I mean, I don't think any diplomats are ever skillful nowadays can do that sort of thing.
So when you say that you also had under your supervision or under your jurisdiction also the intelligence service, British intelligence service operating in Iran, but the Americans didn't, that means that they were totally independent.
No, I think that used to be the case. I think it had been vastly improved. I can't swear to that, but I think that the CIA used to have, probably changing that, I think it's less now, at times, a much more independent link. It depended on how powerful the head of the CIA was. Mm. I suspect that in Dulles' day, the other Dulles' day, it was much more independent and powerful than ambassador. I think it had been shifting and changing during my day. But I don't think it had quite the same, it was so powerful. I mean, the CIA headquarters in London, the monies they had, just dwarfed anything that MI6 could ever have hoped to have had. Secondly, MI6 at the top came under the Foreign Office anyhow. I mean, there was somebody alongside them all the time from the Foreign Office. I don't think that was true of the State Department, the CIA. Mm. They had the S officers, but not the same.
And what was the role of the British intelligence service in Iran?
Well, the primary the value to it was the liaison with Sadak.
About what, though?
About all the threats in the Middle East, the possibility of communist uprisings, all that sort of thing.
Oh, I see. It was in relation to sort of more general things.
Exchanges of information, Russia and matters of general interest. Obviously, Sabat wasn't going to tell us too much about the things that wasn't in in the Shah's interest for us to know. We have to find it out for ourselves if we wanted to know. So we would operate as far as we could independently of Sabak. But a good deal of the, a lot of the valuable information came from Sabak, and they got a lot of valuable for us. For instance, I would myself use MI6 reports to tell the Shah something about what was going on in Iraq, which was dangerous to Iran.
I see, because at the time you were sort of backing Iran against Iraq?
Well, actually, we'd have told the Iraqis something that was useful to them to know about Iran. I don't know, it depends. It depends what's valuable to the country.
Yes.
It's valuable to know. Like Khrushchev spent his suggestion to Eisenhower that they should exchange spies. The most sensible suggestion ever made.
I mean, what would be the purpose of it?
But then they wouldn't be so frightened of each other. And the sort of imagination that it is rife in Persia that the British are behind Khomeini and all that would be less fears, which are born of imagination and fright and so on, but the fears, I guess, they are the worst counselors. Fear is the worst counselor, both for individuals and for nations. And wars are started more from misjudged appreciations, born of fear than anything else in the industry. So one major thing that is valuable for an ambassador who is there to keep peace, for his own country's sake and now can do, is to allay fears as far as possible. If he does that successfully, he's a very good ambassador. One of the ways to allay his fears is to remove the cause of the fear and assure and give assurance which can be believed that the facts, suspected facts, are not true.
When the, in 1953, it was alleged, and one doesn't know what the truth is behind it, that the CIA sort of connived to bring the Shah back 3 days after he had left the country and overthrow Mossadegh and so on, and spend a lot of money. What was the role of the British in that particular coup, if there was such a
I've forgotten now. I think I rather think Monty Woodhouse writes all about it in his book, I think. I haven't read. It's all in there. I rather think that we were much responsible, through the Rashidian brothers, I'm told, for having set the thing up, the undermining of Mossadegh. One time we were wanting, before Zahidi came forward, we wanted that other Ghulam Kalam, Q-U, something other, we wanted him to succeed, to take over. But of course it did, then he failed. And I think a lot of the trio for setting it all up and arranging it all was done by MI6's contacts. I didn't think the CIA had the name of ones. And then Archie Roosevelt, who was brilliant in his own way, came and supplemented all that. And I think it was a rather a joint operation towards the end. The Americans putting probably the clout in with their money and things like that. And maybe the British had the contributors on the with all the ingredients, you see.
And on the intelligence side,
you mean? Well, I think they both probably operated together. But I think that's not badly documented. I wasn't there, but I think that most of that is in Monty Woodhouse's story. And the Shah came back. I think he would have come back anyhow. I think he just played for a bit. The Shah changed, of course. I mean, I think he was sobered up when his first of his attempted assassinations sobered him up enormously. He used to be a playboy, rather, and go to the nightclubs. I remember John Russell, Sir John Russell, who married Miss World, you know, E.G. Russell. And he was counselor there, I think as late as the 60s or early 60s. They used to go out to nightclubs with the Shah about and all that. And then he sobered up. And then on the picnic occasion, was one of his Praetorian guard tried to shoot him. And I think the bullet went through his cheek and out the other side and all that. And then, thereafter, he thought he was preserved by some divinity. Which is a very dangerous thing to have. Macarius thought the same, but it was equally dangerous, because he had a miraculous escape, and I was there as British High Commissioner. It was very bad for him, but he then thought that he was inviolate and had this divine will and so on. The Shah, curiously, the Shah, although he went rather perfunctory, it was not enough to attend a Muslim prayers and visit and go and visit Muslim sites and mosques. I don't think he was a Mohammedan heart. He had these fantasies, he had these ideas, I think, about Zoroastrianism. In fact, Tony Parsons told me, I think, about that since my day, he tried to change the calendar, I think, back to the Zoroastrian one. And when we were there in the 1972, there was this, I remember, he went and communed with the bones of his so-called ancestors. They weren't his ancestors at all, of course, but Cyrus the Great and all that at Pasargadae. And he would commune with the bones. It was very Wagnerian, the whole thing. And you heard, you imagine got a demoralizing atmosphere that he conjured up, rather unhealthy. And I think he had, Asadullah told me, he had rather like Socrates, had this daimon on his shoulder, you know, who would caution him. I think the Shah, actually, I think he did believe he had his daimon of fate. It was, as I say, more about the Wagnerian type of attitude mixed up with Zoroastrianism. It wasn't at all healthy, I don't think. But it did get him through, and he felt fated, and that he was being preserved for these great works in the world. And I think that was a very different Shah, certainly to the one when we went out with Mossadegh, for the Mossadegh thing in 51, when he was a timid, cautious, not very nice, not a very nice person. And then, rather frightened. And of course, anybody who'd be brought up like that by Reza Shah would have been. We really got to see those photographs of this young man, with rather chinless man in a peak cap, standing beside this enormous fellow in an army coat, Reza Shah, on some railway going through to the Caspian. They used to go around together. He was to be terrified of this father, who was exacting so much from him. Very difficult for a child. And that, and the mixture of La Rose in Switzerland, must have been a very awkward combination to grow up with, I think. And I think it told throughout his life. And he had this mixture of bravery, in a way. I mean, he was a lonely person. He didn't very much work for his country. With ruthlessness and a streak of cruelty, which is a sign of weakness in him all his life. But I think, I still think that it was when the French doctors came out, I think it was skin cancer that he had then. And also, I think they came to treat his mother, who was very ill. And I think from then onwards, he gradually, I suspect, gradually lost confidence in himself as the cancer got worse. But it was only a skin cancer. I don't think it was a serious one, but I think it troubled him a lot.
You said something about it is about time that somebody rehabilitate the Shah, apart from the fact that, of course, events have so far rehabilitated his reign, because what has happened since is just so horrendous, but...
There's quite a comparison.
There's no comparison. But you meant that personally somebody ought to rehabilitate him. What do you mean, anyway?
Well, I mean, again, these are comparisons, but if you compare this Shah with some of the 19th century Shahs, I mean, there was a man who really was trying a mission for his country. Nobody else tried before. I'm sure he lined his own nest, and everybody did, in his own way, the Parliament Foundation and all that. The Sharpur report are getting his cut off all the time, all those things. Of course they did, but he did work 12 hours a day, not many people did. He denied himself a lot of relaxation. And, although you can't believe half you read in Mission for My Country, and I, my own witness, how you go around in the Education Corps and the Health Corps, they did a lot. The standard of living in villages was greatly improved, the literacy rate was greatly improved, the cooperatives, and he really tried his agricultural cooperatives, or rather on Nancy Lambton's lines and things. He tried these things. I mean, he was interested. He would have experts in to bring these things to his country. He wanted better roads. He did get more. There, a lot of it was Folie de Grandeur too. But at the time, he wouldn't have many. I mean, apart from the students abroad, I mean, most Persians were secretly rather pleased. They're not criticizing him. They're rather pleased what he'd done. Not many people could actually do that. You look around absolute rulers anywhere today, you find how many achieved what he achieved, is all I'm saying. Right, he, Sabak and all that, lamentable. Now, what annoys me, it was true of this end of empire program, it's so unhistorical. It always annoys me so much. They start importing judgments from 1985 from Britain on what was going on in these early days, like 20-something years before. Change has been enormous since then in a country which can't be compared with Britain. They don't have an established civil service going back 300 years. They have civil servants don't owe their loyalties yet. They take it if ever they do. They don't have a police force that we've had for 900 years with their sort of traditions. Why not? Because they don't have a country. I mean, we don't have a country which is beset with tribes, Bactria, Kurdish tribes, with Turks, with Kurds, with threats from everybody. But for 2,000 years they've been threatened and invaded, with Iraqis training saboteurs as they were the border and in Lebanon and places like that. We don't have a country like that. What do you do to hold it together? You have to be ruthless. The only thing you could compare Sabbat with would be the Star Chamber in Elizabethan times in Britain, where exactly the same cruelties were performed. That was about the level you should compare with historically. Some of which we start judging it as though time is at the same level. I get very annoyed by this because people do not understand that countries are separated as much by time as by space. They understand space. That's easy. They don't understand. They are separated by time. And therefore judgment. You won't make a judgment on space. Why should you make a judgment in time? Because you cannot judge another country's development as at the same time speed as your own. Maybe more, maybe less. And we're doing it all the time. And I don't even read histories or journalists or anybody who write like that. It's totally unhistorical. And meaningless, really. And that is, when you ask me about rehabilitating, that is what's happening to Bashar. He's being judged on the wrong timescale. Not only the wrong timescale, but not taking into account the conditions in which he had to operate. And anyone would have had to operate. And if you'd sent Attlee or someone to Bashar at that time, somebody wrote about Vanagia, he'd have had the same problems, have had to resort to the same, they could all or get out. In my judgment.
Now, let us go back to your time in Iran, and after you left, you went to Washington. Was it at the time when Zahedi was Persian ambassador in Washington?
Yes.
Did you keep in touch with each other?
Oh, very much so. I do now, too. He rang me the other day.
So
he was a very poor foreign minister, and by his lights, particularly with Washington, which is a very naive place, I mean, that sort of thing, they're very naive, they're children, really, Americans, when it comes to a hooked-nosed Persian ambassador with bags of caviar and enormous money and living in a sort of thing like that. They all flocked to his parties more there. They were very naive in that sense, and they loved that. He was very good at it, that sort of thing. How good he was on the political side, I'm not sure it mattered very much, because he certainly made his mark there. Foreign minister, he was far too emotional. And when I once, he threatened me once that he would repeat what Mossadegh had done on some, I can't remember what the issue was, but it was a ludicrous thing to threaten a British ambassador like that. And he wasn't very good, and I didn't like him get on with him when he was foreign minister. The Shah should never have appointed him foreign minister. But he was very good when he went to, good in that sense, not my sort of rather dull professional standards, but he did that job very well for the Shah. And he now, rather, he lives in Geneva. He came over the other day, and after Julian Avery, they invited me up, but I couldn't go. And he's on the same character, I think, but he keeps his respect, which is important.
And what about, you were very much interested, became interested in the Iranian special brand of mysticism called Sufism. So did you ever get in touch with the Sufi circles while you were in?
Well, only with the Nematullah order, which was based on Mahan, which is a lovely place tourists very seldom go to. It's an oasis. Is it near Yazd or Kerman? Yeah, I've forgotten. Just up beyond Kerman, on the way to Bam, I think. And quite beautiful, and it has the real spiritual feeling there. That's about the 12th century, I think. 12th century was unique. I mean, I think they've been trying to regurgitate the 12th century ever since. It was the most beautiful time in Persia. The greatest linguistics, the greatest, best writers, mostly up in that area towards the Afghan border, which is now the Afghan border there. They all lived there. And that at Gurgaon and Nishapur, and all those areas there. That's the time of Persia where I like to have lived in. I think it must have shone like a beacon in a darkened world at that time. And those people were so great that people, that it takes centuries before there's light to die out. And I think that it has gone down. It's been obviously adulterated and darkened. I think it continued. And of the order, I don't know much about the other orders, but I think the Nematullah order has been very pure and remained very pure since, and serious. And Dr. Nurabash, who was, I think, a tutor, psychology tutor, I think, at the university, had been trained as a young man and had been adopted and been a disciple and had been through the whole thing very seriously. So he'd really been through the works, which is quite a thing, because you have to be subjected wholly to your teacher and give up to him. And he continued it, but he then intellectualized it much more, which you may or may not agree with. I rather regret that. I think that's a pity. And not only intellectualized, but externalized it by going abroad, rather only lately, of course, and starting several Hanukkahs in Los Angeles, New York, Washington, Seattle, I've forgotten where they are, all over the place. Now, very popular in America, very, very alive, but very strict and very correct, no fences there. And, of course, in London, in Notting Hill Gate, Notting Hill Gate, Chepstow Road, where they must have got well endowed by some Persians, I think, a lot of money, because they bought the house next door. I don't know where the money comes from. That's very good. And I've heard them a bit with the Home Office, who would had to be cleared, and I vouch for them that they are right, correct, and so on. I've helped his wife come over here once on a visa, and I can't help his daughter, she wants to go, I can't do that. And I do that sort of thing, and I like him, and I go and see him, and he's a rather amusing and witty man. I would have thought, I don't think he's handing on very much, which he should be doing, to someone to come after him. I don't think he himself necessarily has reached the very great heights. I don't think that was his role. I think his role was probably the one he's performing, which is not a great high mysticism in himself, but considerable knowledge, real knowledge, of all the ingredients of what has made up the Sufism in its various forms, which is highly complicated, too complicated for me. I mean, I don't break down the spiritual experience quite in the literary way, which is broken down by them, but that is how it was, and he hasn't invented these things, he's put it together. It's an encyclopedist in a way, and I no doubt he's brought a great deal of satisfaction to a lot of people in America, and I've seen some of his young disciples in London who are very sensible and serious and joyful and happy, and what more could you give anybody as a disciple?
What about other personalities in Iraq that have sort of impressed you?
I always liked everybody knew Haveda, I liked him, you couldn't be more sophisticated than the man of the world than Haveda. But his was essentially a French influence, as opposed to but rather than English one. I mean, his life had been very much, at the most impressionable age, been touched by the French. He retained that all his life. And it's a sort of a French wit, rather than a sense of humour, and so on. You could say that, I think. Very clever man, in an impossible position, held that position longer than anybody else succeeded in doing. I mean, his successors tried, clever people like that, they simply hadn't got the character that he had, or the nimbleness to survive the Shah, because it was impossible to be Prime Minister to a Shah. I think by sheer nimbleness, and wit, and quickness, and cleverness, and knowing when to assemble, when to pass the blame onto others, and he did his best within his that character.
He didn't want to talk politics, did he?
Oh, yes.
What did he say about the situation? I mean, whenever you said we're going too far with the petrol, quadrupling the price and that kind of thing.
I didn't talk to him about that. I didn't think I'd talk to him because I was wholly engaged with the Shah on that. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that would have helped very much at the time. But I would talk on other matters. I mean, we would talk about the... anything big, like the Abu Musa, and those islands and things like that, which really might have broken off relations with Britain if we hadn't come to some solution, because Shah was so impetuous. Anything like that, he had no influence at all. And I dealt entirely with the Shah on that, and the people who came out to negotiate with him. But on that scale, I wouldn't have done, but we would talk about, and he would never really unbutton very much, we would talk about our own British relations and setting up education, we talked about them, but he's very keen on starting the French university at Hamadan, and I wanted to do something else, that sort of thing. But he would never get into deep politics, because deep politics meant the Shah all the time, and he would never talk to me about the Shah.
He would.
Asadullah Alam was different. There I could talk about almost anything. Alam was the one confidant, the one person whom I could talk with anything that you talked to the Shah about. But it really wasn't worth one's while, frankly, to talk other than I used to see him about this or that financial matter. I'd see Haveda or some ICI or Vickers would like the privilege of this or that, or could we help, or vice versa. I would see him or Abshah, who was the, is it Abshah, the little economic minister?
Ansari,
little gentleman who was it went to his head, he became a little cuckoo fellow. And I would talk with the Anna Musigar, people I get, I would talk with them on their departmental businesses. You see.